Jeff has very kindly agreed to answer any questions or some questions which people may have.
Be some questions, because we haven't got Dimbleby here.
Okay. Some questions. Is there any? Yes.
To what extent do you think that mainstream economists are aware that there's a crisis?
Well, it varies. I mean, some have repented. For example, Posner, the law and economics man, he went and actually read the general theory for the first time and then realised that Keynes probably made more sense of what he was observing than anybody else. On the other hand, if I listen to conversations in our faculty in the Stone Room in the Austin Robinson building, either they don't discuss what's going on unless they're sensible people like William Peterson, or they're very annoyed at what they think are illiterate and ill-informed attacks on what they actually do, such as I've just presented to you. And there was a very interesting paper, I couldn't find it, but by Eric Maskin, who was pointing to what he thought were theoretical developments, which did help to give you insights into what was going on. And that's why I say I think there is a problem, but we mustn't throw away a lot of the developments that people have made, and particularly the techniques of analysis that they provide us with, because some of them may be adapted and to be very useful. I mean, I remember when Joseph Steindl got very enthusiastic about mathematics and in economics, and Kaletsky warned him not to be carried away, because he said the great trap is that you look for tractability rather than economic intuition in using mathematics. And provided you keep that at the back of your head, then of course we can use all the tools that and adapt, which mainstream economists have provided us with. But it's partly because the subject has been balkanized, so many people are specialized, it's not their area. You know, when people come up to me and say, and I tell them I'm an economist, which is the greatest conversation stopper of all times, of course, but anyway, and they say, oh, what's your field? And I say, that's a terrible American remark. The greatest compliment that was ever paid to me was by an Indian friend of mine at the World Bank, who said, I always think of you as the Keith Miller of economics, the last of the great all-rounders. Now, Keith Miller was my boyhood hero. He and Lindwell were the great fast bowlers in Bradman's team, and he also was a wonderful batsman. I think that balkanisation has a very bad effect on people's attitudes to the general state of their subject, because they're experts in what they do, but they don't know much about the other a lot of what else is going on, and they don't take an interest in it. And moreover, our training of graduates now in economics, because we suffer from physics envy, is such that we think that economics began 10 years ago with a moving peg. And so we keep rediscovering often inferior forms of old wheels that people who've been brought up on the history of the subject would be familiar with. So I think there is some unease running through mainstream economics. On the other hand, with few exceptions, all the mavericks have been purged, certainly from the Ivy Leagues, almost without exception, and from many other departments. So there's no one there, as it were, as my generation and others die out, to take their place. I mean, Cambridge economics is a wonderful example of this. There's two people left whom teaching now, whom you could say belong to what I would regard as the best Cambridge tradition. One is Gabriel Palmer, and the other is Tony Lawson. And in my view, I'm sure Tony will forgive me for saying this, Tony Lawson is a mixed blessing. it's a terrible... I mean, of course, there's an oasis of light in Stirling with Sheila, but it would be ungallant for me to point out that Sheila's not the young person now that I first met nearly 30 or 40 years ago. And though I always say I went from my first childhood to my second with nothing in between, the fact remains that it's very hard to find the recruits, as it were, to do the tasks that are necessary. However, you must remain an optimist. I've always remained an optimist, but I've also know that just because your cause is right, don't think it's going to triumph, because it doesn't necessarily do so. Look at what's happened over the last week in the UK. We are now entering a slough of despair ruled by Cameron Light and Boy George.
Okay, so anyone?
John Witch.
John.
Forgive me if I don't mean to compartmentalize, but The General Theory was perhaps the greatest book written in macroeconomics. What would you say has been the best book on macroeconomics since Keynes?
That's a very good question, and I'll leave out...
Because I can't answer that question.
I'll leave out economic activity. Well, my own view is that Kaletsky has a claim to be the greatest all-round economist of the 20th century, because he independently discovered the principal propositions of the general theory, and in a much more suitable setting coming out of Marx, his background in Marx and his analysis of capitalism. And then, of course, he wrote seminal papers on democratic socialist planning and on development economics. But, of course, he wrote books of essays, but he never wrote a tome. Similarly, Nicky Cowdor, who I regard as the person nearest to Keynes in the post-war period in Cambridge, because of his great originality, his wide-ranging interests, his membership of the House of Lords, he again never left a great tome, though he did leave in his last book, published long after he died, called Causes of Growth and Stagnation in the World Economy. He does set out both his own pilgrim's progress through economic theory and how his last views of how the world works, the world. Nicky, I don't know how many people know Nicky, but the idea that he was ever a neoclassical economist is an absolute mystery, because he had no idea what a constraint was. He always said exactly what he thought. He was a great boozer, he was a great eater, he was a great womanizer, but as they said when he died, people might have been irritated by him, but they end up being very fond of him. But again, with the exception of this last book, he never left a great tome. Like my generation was brought up on three great books, The General Theory, Value and Capital, and The Foundations. And I don't think that there have been their equivalents since then, though of course there have been very important papers written and very great insights provided by a variety of people. And it's partly, of course, that all the signals tell you to write articles and not to write books. I mean, in the RAE, a book is for the birds, or even the blokes, you know. It doesn't count, and that is so stupid, because sometimes you need to write a book. Sometimes you need to write an article. I mean, And people sometimes write a book when they should have written an article. The person, I think, who most exemplifies that is Tibor Skotowski, who was very disappointed at the response of the profession to his book, The Joyless Economy. Now, if he'd written that as an article, it would have been, you know, regarded as a seminal and classic article. But because it was a book, it was very, very, lots of very good ideas, and it never took off. So there's a problem. But I think there's a role for both writing books and for writing articles. And though we know that Adam Smith and Karl Marx and probably Keynes wrote articles, would never get tenure these days in an Ivy League, I, as I say, I think there's still a case for writing books where you can draw out lots of things and systematize them. But the other thing is that Maurice Dobb pointed out that we've drawn the boundaries of economics so far in, and we need to expand the boundaries more generously drawn by our classical pioneers, is how he said it. Now, I agree that Becker thought that he had a theory of everybody's behaviour. I mean, marriage, divorce, extramarital activity. He never understood about time series analysis, even the economics of suicide. But I think that his use of what is put much better in Wicksteed's Common Sense of Political Economy is a rather sterile and barren approach to understanding the human condition. So my answer is I can't think of one either, but if only Kolesky had written a book. However, I must say that there are a couple of classic books which have greatly influenced me and which I think stand alone. One is Vicky Chick's book on the general theory, and the other will be, I think, Lance Taylor's book, which I referred to at the beginning of the lecture.
Yes.
What is the distinction between mainstream economics and not mainstream economics?
Good question. But as you know, the biggest fool can ask a question which the wisest person can't answer. But I will have a try to answer it anyway. Not that you're a fool, by the way. Well, I think that mainstream economics has to start, says it starts from a foundation of maximising and minimising behaviour under constraints. If you can't trace back what you're doing to that as the starting point, you're being ad hoc. Whereas I think that heterodox economics looks at the world, looks at behaviour, and simplifies the behaviour down to make it manageable, and then builds up the models which are and theories which are necessary for the issue that you're looking at, regardless of whether you think there's maximising or non-maximising behaviour there. You take it from observations. I mean, Nicky Caldor used to talk about stylized facts, and the need then to design a model and a theory which the inferences of which matched up with the stylized facts. So that's why I, as Sheila said, I believe in horses for courses, that you model according to what you're working on, and sometimes there may be maximizing behavior, sometimes there may be satisfying behaviour. Sometimes there may be conventional behaviour, sometimes there may be irrational behaviour. It depends on the issues that you're looking at. You shouldn't beg the question when you look at the world. Whereas my great friend and mentor Eric Russell used to say that the worst sorts of economists were those who got off the aeroplane and gave advice, because they already had a model in their head as to how the world worked. As Friedman said, once we left the Garden of Eden, supply and demand ruled. And probably the money supply as well. Whereas if Kolesky was asked when he arrived at a place to do some work on advising the government, if he was asked as he got off the plane, he said, well, you can't ask me now. Come back in 6 months when I've had a chance to absorb your historical background, your sociological characteristics, your institutions, and I've got a feeling for how your world works. And then I may have some tentative policy suggestions to make, and so I think that is the difference. The mainstream have model, will travel. That's why a lot of them are tarmac professors. You know, they call into their Ivy Leagues to pick up their checks, whereas other people soak themselves in the problem that they're interested in. For example, Austin Robinson and Keynes, if they were thinking about specific issues, would actually start off with a blank piece of paper and then start writing down, you know, what are the statistics on this, what are the sort of behaviour that people are doing, and then try and put it together. And of course, Keynes often knew the answer before he had the theory. I mean, he had great intuitive jumps into what the answer must be. But then he devised a theory to make sure that he got that answer. And Austin Robinson and Brian Redaway, who were two of the cleverest people I ever met, were really brought up on two books. They were steeped in Marshall and steeped in the general theory, and they built up their approach to all the many, many problems that they tackled on the basis of that, and adaptation and extension and development of a basic set of principles that they'd absorbed. So I think that there is a big difference, and that's not to say that there aren't some wonderful mainstream economists. One of my great heroes was Jim Tobin. I think in many ways Bob Solow, when he stays in the short period, as a Keynesian, has been a force for enlightenment. Paul Samuelson has been very good on policy. I mean, one of the ironies is that there are many branches of Keynesianism who are at one another's throats theoretically, but by and large they come up with very similar policy proposals, slightly varied according to how right wing or left wing they are, and whether they were Cold War warriors or more left wing. But it is an irony that, and I've always said they should have a united front against the forces of darkness, regardless of their theoretical differences. That was a very rambly answer. I do apologise.
Sorry.
Sorry.
This
is an observation rather than a question, but I was reminded after your story about the shock effect of Lucas's lecture of about 2 or 3 years after Terence Gorman left LSE, he was invited back to give a special university public lecture, and he arrived and Dick Lipsey was chairing and said the appropriate things. And at that point Terence looked rather embarrassed and said he'd misread the invitation, because he hadn't read it as a special university lecture, public lecture, but a public university lecture for specialists. And then proceeded to go off into the stratosphere for about an hour and a half.
That'll be Terence. Is there anyone here who doesn't know who Terence Gorman?
To explain.
Well, Terence Gorman was the guru of the great group at Birmingham in the 40s and 50s. He was a graduate of Trinity College, Dublin, and then I think he did a DPhil at Oxford. Anyway, he was a genius. And he was the mentor of Frank Hahn and Alan Walters and Ezra Benathan and David Rowan, a credible group of youngsters who were in their 20s or early 30s at Birmingham in the 40s and 50s, and then he went on Oxford. But he was a genuine Irishman, wasn't he? He's a really quirky fella. And he didn't believe in publishing, and he didn't believe in his friends publishing either. And so he's a bit like Trevor Swan. His filing cabinets were filled with seminal papers that other people got the credit for, because he'd never put them out. And, for example, I always tease Frank Hahn about this. I think his PhD is the best thing he ever did, and it's been downhill all the way since then. But he didn't publish that until 20 years after it was accepted, because Terence told him not to. And it really was a great pity. It was a very, very original piece of work. And it was right.
Yes.
Before I ask the question, I must say that in 1972 I was standing at second slip to your first slip on St. John's cricket grounds, because the economics faculty co-opted me to do some cricket for them. I was in the science faculty, and I wondered always how you had the time to do this, and once you told me that while I'm standing at slip I may be formulating a paper.
If I told you that, I'm a liar. you don't mix religion.
Well, my question is, I had two things emanating from your very enlightening talk. One that occurred to me was, what is the role of information asymmetry in all these markets and disequilibrium of markets, especially in the context of this electronic world that we are entering. That is one. And the second, more interesting one, which I heard from the originator of the Logo programming language in MIT, I forgot his name now, he said that always, like the Russians do, in economics you must talk in macro terms but really do everything in micro terms.
Uh-huh.
So the other question.
Yes. Now, what was the first one again? The asymmetry. Yes.
Yes.
Well, there's no doubt about it that mainstream economists have made some very interesting analysis of the results of asymmetric information. Stiglitz and Merleys and others have done that. But of course, as Joe Stiglitz, when he did his work on credit rationing and the fact that prices in the financial markets don't just tell you one dimension, namely scarcity, they tell you a lot, give you lots of other information. He did, towards the end of the series of papers he did with Weiss, he did say, of course, the basic idea came out of Kolesky's principle of increasing risk, first published in 1937, so that there's an overlap there. That's and of course that's very important to look for that. Now your second question was macro and micro.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from the 70s on, people in economics got very absorbed with providing the microeconomic foundations of macroeconomics. But unfortunately, that meant that they forgot about the fallacy of composition and the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And in the only session which the American Economic Association meetings have ever had on post-Keynesianism, there was a wonderful paper by James Crotty, who's a progressive Marxist Keynesian economist in America, who said, never mind about the microeconomic foundations of macroeconomics, from the classicals and Marx, and also from Keynes, we get the macroeconomic foundations of microeconomics.
Yes.
And one of the things that Omerod, I think, points out in his paper is that in physics, physicists are very used to looking at system behaviour. They don't expect that to be just a simple summation of micro behaviour, though they do go and look at micro behaviour. And the person who has most developed this insight in recent years, I believe, and this is my answer to your question, John, is there's an extraordinary book by Wynn Godley and Mark LeVar, came out about 2 years ago, which is really the macroeconomic foundations of microeconomics, in a sense. It comes out of Marshall and Keynes, mainly, and Wynn has been working on this for about 40 years, from when he was first the first forecaster in the British Treasury. I think that Crotty's remark was a very, very important one. And if there is some overlap with physics methodology and economics methodology, though I think with Keynes and with Vicky Chick that we're a moral science, and or with Hicks, who said that we're on the verge of science and we're on the verge of history, I think that's a much better way of looking at it. We do have common ground with the physicists there, and that is a very important thing to do. That's why I thought Bob Rowthorne's suggestion that we must systematically develop the systemic effects of wide networking in financial markets for the operation of the economy is a very, very important one. And we have at Cambridge at the moment Professor Goyal, who's one of the world's experts on networks, and he actually was invited by Soros to the great Soros Feast in King's when 150 of the world's most innovative and heterodox economists were invited to give a to sit round for, I think, 12 hours a day and chew the cud. And everything in Cambridge, Oxbridge, is born in food and drink. But in between that, they had to talk. And Goyal had 12 minutes, I think, to present his ideas there. He was told he had 20 minutes, but then he was cut down to 12 because I think he was on the same platform, I may be wrong, as Stiglitz. And Stiglitz doesn't understand about constraints when he's talking either.
Okay. Chris,
Slightly touches on that. You talked about intellectual boundaries of economics and whether it should go beyond them, and you've talked a few times about physics envy and so on, and I'm wondering if you have a view on the efforts of some economists to engage with other disciplines. Sheila's interested in this too, I believe, in terms of, you know, behavioral psychology,
yeah,
psychoanalysis and so on. I'm thinking particularly of the Akerlof and Schiller books.
Yes. Well, of course, you know, I think many of those developments are of extreme interest. When I first read a book on complexity, I thought if only I were to start again, and if I had the necessary mathematical skills, which I haven't, because it's very hairy mathematics, that might be a way I'd like to go. And then I have a great friend who's one of the brightest people I have ever met, who's gone mad on neuroeconomics, neuroscience in economics. Some of you may have heard of him, John Coates. He hit the headlines when he established, like all economics, its truths are obvious after someone else tells you what they are. What he discovered was that young men, after a certain point, go bananas, both in the upswing and the downswing on the stock exchange. But if you only had older men or women on the stock exchange, you wouldn't have as great swings. But he did that by taking their saliva and testing what was happening in their brain. Anyway, his paper had a huge hit.
It's all in the saliva.
It's all in the saliva. Also, I mean, of course, there's psychology is coming into economics. And of course, we must remember that Marshall said that the mecca of economics was biology. And he himself, and I've just examined one of the greatest PhDs I've ever come across by a bloke called Neil Hart. It's for the University of New South Wales, so he teaches at the University of Western Sydney, and he's written some splendid papers on Marshall. But this is about Marshall then and now, and the Marshallian dilemma that he rightly was proud of his use and application of static analysis, but he viewed the world as an evolving biological entity. But when he was alive, evolutionary theory hadn't reached a steady enough state for him to be able to take, as it were, the conventional wisdom and apply it in his economics. And so he never solved the basic dilemma of his intellectual life. But what Hart points out, that in recent years, with a more settled state of evolutionary theory in biology, we're in a position for evolutionary theory to be very helpful in this understanding the processes that work in the development of modern economies. And after all, I'm sure Marx tweaked this as well, because he did talk about the organic composition of capital, and though Francis Wheen has shown that Darwin politely refused to allow him to dedicate the first volume of Capital to him, but there was some exchange on it. So that I agree that let a hundred, no, was it a thousand or a hundred flowers bloom? What did Mao? A thousand, I think. But let them state their assumptions, Joan Robinson said.
Okay. If we have no further questions, it falls to me to bring this discussion to a close. I'll just say, on behalf of all those who have had similar difficulties in deciphering Jeff's handwriting, which I always thought was because, you know, I wasn't an Australian, I can't read Australian handwriting, but it's to you know, now that I see that Jeff has the same problem, I'm relieved. I just say that, you know, Jeff is really one of the few caring scholars in economics. He was always there for younger scholars, in particular, as I know from my own experience, for scholars and friends in difficulties. I know that when we are kind to our students, it's to our students and to younger scholars, it's because we're passing on something that we received in bucketfuls from Jeff. We're all socialized through our studies to look up to professors as models that we should seek to emulate. I'd like to conclude this discussion just with the observation, in respect of Jeff's Jeff's position at Cambridge. I'd conclude with the observation of this: one thing better than being a professor, and that is being an intellectual and a generous and genuine human being like Jeff. So I'd like to ask you to put your hands together one last time for Jeff.
Professors are pigs, and what could a pig do but grunt? And he also said, and I had to put a moratorium on this for a while, he said, the proof of the existence of God is the fact that when Milton Friedman sits down, his feet do not touch the ground. And I always thought that was a philosophically profound statement, but I haven't the faintest idea what it means.